Well, I do not know how accurate the ABC report is. It's been denied by the authorities, or some of them anyway. And also, the FBI has denied that there was any link between Boz and any heroin, Lebanese-based heroin smuggling ring. I note, though, the initial speculation in this regard, because in Radio Free America number 35, we saw graphically illustrated the relationship between the Lebanese drug trade, and in particular the drugs coming out of the Bekaa Valley in Syria, marketed through or transported through, or the Bekaa Valley in Lebanon, rather, controlled by the Syrians, and one of the generating points for the Middle Eastern drug traffic, the connections between the Bekaa Valley drug traffic, the Syrian government, elements of the Palestinian National Movement, the fascist Third Position, and last but most assuredly not least, elements of our own national security establishment, such as the forces grouped around Oliver North during the Iran-Contra scandal. We took a look at those and their connections to the murky world of intelligence, counterintelligence, and international terrorism in Radio Free America program number 35, The December Surprise, The Politics of Terror, and the Exoneration of the Secret Team. We also took a look at the connecting links between elements of our own national security establishment and Middle Eastern terrorism manifesting itself right here in the United States in an addendum to Radio Free America program number 38, The Terror Connection Part 3, dealing with the World Trade Center bombing and U.S. intelligence connections to Sheikh Rahman. By the way, I apologize again to newer listeners for the speed with which I'm going through much of this supplemental discussion, but that is why the archive shows are critical. There's simply no way that I can recapitulate the hours and hours and hours of supporting documentation for the arguments that I'm setting forth. So again, note the allegations, denied hotly, that Boz was connected with a Lebanese drug ring. That is a pattern we've seen in the past connected with terrorism that was aided and abetted by some elements of our own national security establishment. Note, too, the report also denied that from ABC News that Boz was part of a terrorist group. We'll see if there turns out to be anything more to those stories, or what do the denials hold up under investigation and scrutiny. I would note, too, that the sentiments that are running so high right now, certainly on both the Palestinian and Israeli sides, emotions are extremely bitter, and this will not facilitate the Middle East peace process. I would note, too, that the more extreme elements in the Middle Eastern situation, the most violent, the most militant, and the most polarized elements, have historical links going back to the forces of fascism during World War II. Again, we've taken a look at elements of the Palestinian National Movement allied with the fascist Third Position. There are strong fascist connections to elements, note the use of the term elements, of the Palestinian National Movement. In Radio Free America number 32, for example, as well as the miscellaneous two-part archive series dealing with the fascist Third Position, we took a look at connecting links between such groups as the Abu Abbas group and elements associated with the Sportgruppe Hoffmann, a German neo-Nazi group, which has cropped up in the context of both European and Middle Eastern terrorism over the decades. We took a look at the Sportgruppe Hoffmann, and in Radio Free America 32, also in Radio Free America program number 19, Radio Free America, and the miscellaneous two-part archive show dealing with the fascist Third Position. Also some addenda to Radio Free America program number 35, also material in RFA 38. I would note that the fascist Third Position has, as I said, strong operational links and connections which join elements of Middle Eastern terrorism with European neo-fascists and also extreme left-wing terrorists in Europe. The fascist Third Position also aims at attracting members of more progressive political outlooks to the fascist movement. Some of the heroes of the fascist Third Position are Louis Farrakhan of the Nation of Islam, Muammar Gaddafi, the Ayatollah Khomeini, as well as Mao and Hitler. There are also very strong connecting links between the fascist Third Position and the P2 Lodge of former SS officer Licio Gelli. That institution represented, in effect, a crypto-fascist government of Italy. It has very strong connections to elements of our own national security establishment, including and especially the Reagan-Bush-Oliver North connections of or elements of our national security establishment. Note, again, the similarity in the rhetoric between Shmuel HaKohen, an associate of Meir Kahane, whose organization and send the related elements are the successors to the explicitly fascist element of the Zionist movement. Note the similarity between the rhetoric of Shmuel HaKohen and the rhetoric of Khalid Mohammed, follower of Louis Farrakhan, because as we're going to see, some of the ideological mystification that the fascists engage in has permitted both elements, such as the fascist Zionists and elements such as Farrakhan, the Nation of Islam, and before that, the Nation of Islam under Elijah Muhammad, to find a workable position within the fascist cosmology. This is not to say, and this is a very important point, that the elements, for example, of the black nationalist movement that have allied with explicitly fascist elements are themselves fascist, although at least in some elements, I think, with regard to some elements, a case could be made, but rather that these elements will work with explicitly fascist elements. They are seen to a certain extent as furthering explicitly fascist elements, and the same has also been true historically of elements such as the Beitarim and the Stern Gang. We're going to take a look, first of all, at some of the rhetoric that is being engaged in by not Nation of Islam members specifically, but by young political leaders, college students, who find grounds for agreement with the rhetoric of people like Khalid Mohammed. Reading now from the San Francisco Examiner of Tuesday, March 1st of 1994, this is an article by Jonathan Tilove, or Tilove, T-I-L-O-V-E, of the Newhouse News Service at Stateline, Washington, headlined, "Many black students admire Nation of Islam." Subheaded, "Its leaders' belligerence toward Jews strikes a chord among students at two universities." Skipping down in the story, simply put, "Anyone waiting for black students, the rising generation of black leaders, to repudiate the Nation of Islam will have a very, very long wait." I do not know if the Nation of Islam and people like Farrakhan and Khalid Abdul Muhammad are as popular with young black intellectuals, black college students, as they appear to be from this article. I don't have enough first-hand experience with black college students. But if the perception expressed here, and again I'll repeat this sentence, simply put, "Anyone waiting for black students, the rising generation of black leaders, to repudiate the Nation of Islam will have a very, very long wait." If the affinity between some black students and the between the black student community, I should say, and the Nation of Islam is as good as this article seems to indicate in certain respects, then that is a very disturbing pattern, and it's something which ultimately will hurt the black community in this country and may very well hurt a whole lot of may very well hurt people well beyond the boundaries of the black community in the United States. Skipping down into this particular story, we're going to see a quote now from a fellow named Malik Zulu Shabazz, a Howard University student who invited Mohammed to address a group of students at Howard University. Quote, "This is an aggressive, hardcore generation, and we want an aggressive, hardcore message," unquote, said Malik Zulu Shabazz, the Howard University student who brought the charismatic Mohammed before an overflow crowd of more than 1,000 last week. "It was a crowd that was all the more zealous in its enthusiasm because of the criticism that Muhammad has endured, criticism that has made him, in the words of the posters plastered on the Howard campus, quote, the man the enemy is afraid of, the man repudiated by Negro leaders," unquote. Skipping down, Shabazz obviously revels in assigning Jews special responsibility for the oppression of blacks. While even Farrakhan condemned what he called the repugnant manner in which Muhammad criticized Jews and others in a now celebrated December speech at Keene College in New Jersey, though Farrakhan stood by the content of that criticism, Shabazz said, quote, "I agree with every statement he made 100%, 1,000%, unquote. Before introducing Muhammad this week, Shabazz endeavored to lead his audience in a call and response of Jewish culpability for crimes against blacks. Quote, who set up Nat Turner, he asked. Who is it that controls the Federal Reserve, unquote? And who is it that controls the media and Hollywood, which has black entertainers and athletes in its vice grip, unquote? Yet, Shabazz found himself having to admonish his otherwise tautly attentive audience for insufficient enthusiasm in their shattered reply of, quote, Jews, unquote. Are you afraid to say it? Shabazz asked, provoking a somewhat more energetic Jews to his next question of Jewish guilt. Again, this is rhetoric that would have done Joseph Goebbels proud, and that is ominously reminiscent of exactly the sort of rhetoric that the Third Reich engaged in. It is certainly disturbing to see this being echoed by a young black college leader in the United States today, student leader in the United States today. Again, I do not know how characteristic viewpoints like this are in the black university community. There are certainly is a certain percentage of black political spokespersons who feel an affinity with elements like Muhammad and Farrakhan. And again, it is a disturbing, disturbing trend. And what we're going to be looking at is an aspect of fascism, both ideologically and historically, that permits elements as disparate as the Nation of Islam of Khalid Muhammad, and some of the fascist elements associated with the Zionist movement in the World War II period to find a niche, so to speak, within the world, within the environment of world fascism. And again, note the politically and historically illiterate nature of the perceptions expressed here by this fellow Malik Zulu Shabazz. By the way, I'm not calling this individual a fascist, but rather many of the perceptions are proto-fascistic, and it is disturbing to see this sort of debased political culture elevated in certain circles. I also wonder about the role of the media in elevating a Louis Farrakhan or a Khalid Abdul Muhammad, given all of the intelligent and relevant political black political science in the United States. One wonders why the media continue to focus, or focus to the extent that they do, on a Khalid Muhammad and a Louis Farrakhan, and to elevate them as black spokespersons when both are, frankly, politically and historically illiterate. The notion of Jews, American or otherwise, being responsible for the historical problems of African people of African extraction in America gets an A for originality, and that's just about it. I would also note that historically in the United States, both the black and Jewish communities have been two of the pillars of the progressive political community, and that historically cooperation between the two has had much to do with forming some of the more meaningful political coalitions in the last 30 years. For what it's worth, and by the way, one sees a great deal of the Jewish banking and political conspiracy line of thinking, not just or even primarily in the Afro-American community. One sees a great deal of it, and a growing amount of it, in the Caucasian political circles as well. In particular, the Birch elements have been, and elements associated with the Liberty Lobby have been quite successful in perpetrating the Jewish banking conspiracy theory and aligning the old protocols of the Elders of Zion with the Federal Reserve System and other contemporary political fantasies. One of the interesting aspects of this sort of bogus political science is that America does actually have one particular ethnic group or religious group which is disproportionately represented in the corridors of power. There's a lot of big Catholic money in the United States, too, but the American ruling class, for what it's worth, is Episcopalian. The Episcopal Church is, to a large extent, the American wing, or the Americanized wing, of the old Anglican Church. There's a very good book called The Power of Their Glory. It's by a husband and wife team. I'll have to perhaps produce that in the next several weeks. Their last name is L. Both of the husband and wife's last name is L. I've forgotten their name offhand, but it deals with the Episcopalian ruling class in this country. If you want to see what ethnic group makes up the American ruling class, George Bush, folks, is it. He's Episcopalian, and the degree to which the Episcopalian elite in this country controls the reins of power would shock even some relatively savvy observers. There certainly are other political forces that wield great influence, but it's funny, one never hears about the Episcopalian conspiracy in this country, and yet the American ruling class is still, even several hundred years after, or a couple of hundred years plus after the American Revolution, solidly Episcopalian. But one does not hear about the Episcopalian conspiracy, quote-unquote. Indeed, I would refer to it perhaps as an oligarchy rather than a conspiracy in that sense. What we're going to do now is take a look at some aspects of fascism which permit, as I've said, the unification in the same political landscape of elements like the fascist Zionists with elements that are now manifesting themselves in the form of the Nation of Islam, Farrakhan, Khalid Muhammad, etc. We're going to turn now to a book called Fascism Today, subtitled A World Survey. That book is co-authored by Angelo Del Boca, D-E-L, capital B-O-C-A, and Mario Giovanna, G-I-O-V-A-N-A. These two gentlemen are, of course, Italian. A little bit about the authors. By the way, the book was copyright 1969 and published in hardcover by Pantheon Books, a division of Random House. About the authors, Angelo Del Boca and Mario Giovanna are noted Italian journalists and writers. As special correspondent for Gazzetta del Popolo of Turin from 1948 to 1967, Mr. Del Boca visited many countries, specializing particularly in problems of Africa and the Third World. He's the author of many books and is currently preparing a volume on the daily press throughout the world. Mr. Giovanna is now editor of the political weekly Mondo Nuovo, consulting editor in history for a publishing house, and a regional and national leader in the Italian Socialist Party of Proletarian Unity. And in this book, Fascism Today, A World Survey, there is an analysis of a very important aspect of fascism that in many ways is the foundational element for the line of inquiry that we're conducting at this time. One of the things that fascist ideology has been able to do quite successfully is to mystify and to obfuscate the ideological boundaries between conflicting political philosophies. In many ways, fascism reduced itself to what the authors quite accurately term absolute empiricism, and the reduction to this empiricism of fascist ideology has permitted many disparate elements which were not only opposed to each other, or which one would suppose would be opposed to each other, but in fact opposed to fascism. This ideological mystification, this ideological obfuscation, this blurring of the boundaries between political polarities has permitted some elements that that by all rights should be opposed to fascism to collaborate with the forces of fascism. The authors describe this political mystification, this political obfuscation, this blurring of the boundary lines between a politically polarized and opposite points of view as follows. This is a very important passage because this book was translated from the Italian. It is not necessarily the easiest passage to understand. Well, it's very complex, a relatively complex passage, I should say. The authors write, "Amid all the paraphernalia of Nazi and fascist doctrines and programs, and precisely because each one of them exhausted itself in proclaiming principles and lived on an absolute empiricism, we often come across certain postulates which were calculated to satisfy the most disparate demands. The whole was bundled together or left in the liquid state so that anyone could extract a twig or take a sip and believe that he had discovered the truth." Again, this last sentence. "Amid all the paraphernalia of Nazi and fascist doctrines and programs, and precisely because each one of them exhausted itself in proclaiming principles and lived on an absolute empiricism, we often come across certain postulates which were calculated to satisfy the most disparate demands. The whole was bundled together or left in the liquid state so that anyone could extract a twig or take a sip and believe that he had discovered the truth." And as we'll see, quite a few disparate elements have extracted that twig or taken that sip. Continuing. "The pagan myths of the vitality of the race and the supremacy of brute force went side by side with claims to be the saviors of the integrity of Western Christian traditions. Revolutionary aspirations shot through with muddled socialistic ideals were grafted onto the cult of tribal traditions and an accentuated nationalistic individualism. Anti-capitalism went arm-in-arm with a negation of the class struggle. Quote, Europeanism, unquote, was mingled with xenophobia. Hatred of culture and of ideologies had its Freudian counterpart in a seeking after a cultural and ideological dignity, which plundered the intellectual heritage of many centuries in its efforts to achieve impossible syntheses." In addition to the ideological obfuscation here, the ideological mystification, another political and historical trend or element which permitted the fascist powers of World War II to attract some disparate elements, as the authors have termed them, to the fascist movement, concerned their manipulation of certain anti-colonial and nationalistic forces. Among the subplots, I guess one could say, or among the struggles that were occurring during the course of World War II were the struggles between the German Empire and the British and French empires. And in order to facilitate their conquest of the colonial territories that were held by Great Britain and to a lesser extent France, the Third Reich, as well as the Italian fascists and also the Japanese fascists, were able to form political alliances with anti-colonial and nationalist groups in some of the territories that were British and French colonies prior to and during World War II. The exploitation, the utilization of anti-colonialist forces in various territories that were colonial holdings of some of their international rivals and their enemies, such as Britain and France, permitted the fascist powers to form a number of interesting political alliances, and the successors to some of the alliances that are going to be discussed here are very much on the scene today. And some of the Nazi-linked elements of the Palestinian National Movement, again, a very disparate movement, but some of whose most militant members have ongoing connections to fascism. We've talked about that in numerous archive shows, including Radio Free America 22, the miscellaneous two-part archive series dealing with the fascist third position. Continuing now with Fascism Today by Del Boca and Giovanna. In the glittering heyday of their fame, Germany and Italy contrived to harness the national and nationalistic movements of the Arab world to the policies of Nazism and fascism, just as they had sought to influence similar trends in South America. Ahmed Hussein and his Egyptian, quote, green shirts, unquote, of the Young Egypt Party, Fatih, F-A-T-H-I, Radouan, R-A-D-O-U-A-N, and Nur Edine Taraf, T-A-R-R-I-F, the leaders of the new National Party, got into touch with the Nazis. The Grand Mufti of Jerusalem, Amin al-Hussein, entered into relations at first clandestine and, for reasons of prudence, purely formal with Mussolini's government, with the utmost caution and taking care not to compromise themselves in their public utterances. The leaders of the Tunisian and Algerian liberation movements weighed the advantages of accepting the help of the two regimes in their struggle against French colonialism. Such approaches were not unnatural, and only in the case of the Egyptians and the Mufti did they assume the proportions of a definite alignment with Nazi fascist policies, whereas for the other groups they never got beyond the stage of sporadic contacts, which did not assume the character of an open political alliance. The middle class and the military men who controlled the Arab nationalistic organizations were anti-British owing to the nature of their claims, but this tactical necessity was supplemented by a definite leaning towards the methods and principles of National Socialism, the teachings of which were put to good use by Egyptian officers and were destined to leave a lasting mark. In the radical wing of the Indian nationalist movement, too, the attractions of Nazism and fascism induced the deputy Chandra Subhas Bose to secede from the Congress Party in 1943 and become the head of a government in exile at Singapore and the commander of a, quote, national army, unquote. Anti-Semitism naturally played an important part in these sympathies of the Arab world for the Nazis and fascists. Arab nationalism welcomed the theory of a worldwide Jewish conspiracy against the nations, not so much because it fitted into the general anti-communist scheme, but rather because it was the quintessence of the spirit of the anti-Jewish crusade, which certain elements made the keystone of their campaign to mobilize the masses in the religious field in keeping with the program of the, quote, Muslim Brotherhood, unquote. Similarly, the racial motive was undoubtedly a dominating factor in the popularity which Hitler and National Socialism achieved among certain sectors of the ruling class in South Africa. For 20 years past, the Afrikaners, descendants of the Boer colonizers, had been using the Bible as the gospel of a nationalism and radicalism which to Rosenberg seemed to be the quintessence of his own theories. That's Alfred Rosenberg, head of the Nazi Ostministerium. From the distant extremity of the Dark Continent, they applauded the exploits of the Nazis, who had formulated doctrines which would serve to justify, from a legal point of view as well, the discriminatory measures against the Negroes in the Union. By the way, the historical relationship between the Bruderbund, the dominant ruling group for decades within South Africa, and the German Nazi Party, that is covered in an archive show, a miscellaneous archive show called South Africa, the Third Reich, and the Bomb. Continuing. From the distant extremity of the Dark Continent, they applauded the exploits of the Nazis, who had formulated doctrines which would serve to justify, from a legal point of view as well, the discriminatory measures against the Negroes in the Union. For them, Hitler was a symbol of the, quote, leader, unquote, whose coming, according to their own interpretation of biblical prophecies, had been foretold, a leader who would redeem the world in accordance with the theory of the, quote, chosen people. Now, I would note this notion of a leader, a Führer, redeeming the, quote, chosen people is an aspect of militant ideology and theology which is common not only to the Third Reich, but also to the Afrikaner fascists, as indicated here. It is also common to elements of militant Islam, such as the Nation of Islam in the United States, and also Islamic fundamentalists in countries such as Iran and Algeria. And I would also note that that same notion of a leader leading the chosen people to their destiny is also held by the more militant elements of the Zionist movement as well. Continuing, the Afrikaners believed that they were an integral part of this chosen people. They accordingly misused their power over the colored races, at the same time pocketing the enormous profits made by exploiting the native laborers for the benefit of the white minority in the country, while the condition of the laborers themselves was practically one of slavery. So again, note the relative success that the fascist powers of Europe enjoyed with certain elements which sought freedom from their colonial empire. The Afrikaners, of course, were struggling for independence from Great Britain. South Africa was a British colony. Egypt was also a British colony. Algeria, of course, was a French colony. And the fascist powers of Europe found elements within these colonies, which were so willing to work, to a certain extent anyway, with the forces of fascism, which, as a general consideration, were not anti-colonialist. What the Germans sought to do was to replace the British as the and the French as the colonial masters of these various territories, just as the Japanese, the sponsors of Subhas Chandra Bose, whom we looked at in Radio Free America number 7, the Japanese also sought to replace the British as the colonial masters of India. These were not anti-colonialists. That is to say, the fascists were not anti-colonialist. They were not out to promote freedom and democracy. They were simply out to change places with the existing colonial masters of these territories. However, by skillfully manipulating movements within some of these colonies whose possession they sought, they were able to form political alliances and ideological alliances with elements which, by all rights, should have been opposed to European colonialism. Indeed, the racial doctrines of the Third Reich would have made anyone of Semitic extraction, including Arabs, unacceptable to the Nazi viewpoint of Aryan supremacy, the common ground of anti-Semitism as well as the common ground of anti-British sentiment led to a cooperative pattern between the Third Reich and elements of the Palestinian National Movement. We have seen that relationship blossom over the years into not only the fascist third position that I've already discussed, but also into contemporary German sponsorship of Middle Eastern terrorist groups, Iraqi, Iranian and Algerian terrorists currently being the beneficiaries of the services offered by the BND, the German Intelligence Service, the successor to the Reinhard Gehlen Nazi Eastern Front spy outfit, elements of which were involved in training and arming the first Palestinian terrorists in a CIA-sponsored mission in the early 1950s that we discussed in Radio Free America number 22. Now, I would note that Palestine was a British colony, and just as the Nazis were able to form some political alliances with people like Haj Amin al-Husseini, the self-proclaimed Grand Mufti of Jerusalem, who later became a major in the SS, so too the fascist powers of Europe were able to form political alliances with elements of the Zionist movement as well. We're going to take a look at the evolution of some fascist elements and in the Zionist movement, and also alliances between elements of the Zionist movement and fascism, by way of examining one aspect of the theme of tonight's broadcast, namely strange bedfellows. Bear in mind that elements of the Zionist movement as well sought the removal the Zionist movement in general sought the removal of the British from Palestine and its replacement with a Jewish-dominated government. So that the point being that elements like the Grand Mufti and the forces grouped around him, even though they were anti-Zionist and anti-Semitic, they were also utilized by the Nazis in order to create agitation and to create trouble for the British in the Middle East. Elements of the Zionist movement were viewed in a similar light, and there were some similar alliances formed between the Zionist movement and Nazi Germany and the fascist powers of Europe, even though, again, the fascist Zionists were bitterly opposed to elements like Haji Amin al-Husseini, and those Palestinian elements and Middle Eastern elements that were, or Islamic elements, I should say, that were aligned with the Third Reich. We're going to jump back now, 12 years in time, and we're going to listen to an old Hard Rain show. You're going to listen to yours truly. Hard Rain, by the way, was the first of the archive shows, the first series of archive shows that I've produced. It was roughly a half-hour archive show. My broadcast skills in 1982 were nothing like what they are. I'm not now. I'm not exactly Edward R. Murrow now. So this broadcast is relatively primitive, but it is cogent. It can be understood. And we're going to take a look at one aspect of tonight's Strange Bedfellows broadcast. We're going to take a look at connections between the Zionist political movement and the fascist powers of Europe during World War II.
Hi, my name is Dave Emery, and it's time once again for Hard Rain. Now, during the course of this broadcast, for the next half hour or so, we're going to be talking about something which is increasingly important in the political events of the world today, and something not very many people know about, namely the profound and long-standing connections between Zionism and fascism. That's right, between Zionism and fascism. And if that seems like, I guess one might refer to it as perhaps strange bedfellows, stick around, you know, or we're going to basically delineate some of those connections for you during the course of the program this evening. First of all, we're going to begin by taking a look at the long-standing physical and ideological association between the so-called Beit Harim, or revisionist Zionists, headed by, among others, Menachem Begin, and the Italian fascist regime of Benito Mussolini in Italy. Following that, we're going to take a look at Yitzhak Shamir's participation in an extreme right-wing Zionist group that actually advocated an open military alliance between the Third Reich and Zionist forces during the course of World War II. Following that, we're going to take a look at an early association between the SS and the Haganah, a very influential Zionist organization, which basically has been one of the linchpins of the Zionist movement over the years. And the SS and the Haganah actually worked out a pattern of cooperation. And this strange alliance is one of the things we're going to be taking a look at on the broadcast this evening. Now, we're going to begin, as I said, by taking a look at the physical and ideological associations between the so-called Beit Harim, or revisionist Zionists, and the Italian fascists, headed, of course, by Italian dictator Benito Mussolini. Now, the information that I'm about to present to you comes from an article that appeared in the Village Voice. The article was written by Alexander Coburn, last name C-O-C-K-B-U-R-N, and Coburn's column is called History as the Propaganda of the Victors, and this column by Coburn was carried in the Village Voice article of October 12th, 1982. And by the way, research credit for this article goes to May Brussel, one of the finest assassination and anti-fascist researchers on the scene today, and was May who dug this article up for us. Once again, Alexander Coburn writing from the Village Voice of October 12th, 1982. For one of his recent reports from Israel for the New York Times, David Shipler interviewed the excellent Israeli journalist Amos Elon, last name E-L-O-N, and quoted Elon as referring to the Jewish face of fascism, unquote. Even tucked away at the end of the article, the use of the phrase was striking and brought to mind at once an uproar in August when I quoted here a famous letter to the New York Times signed by Albert Einstein, Hannah Arendt, and others protesting Begin's trip to the United States in 1948 and calling him and his party fascist. I was accused by Saul Stern of fascist baiting in these pages for citing the letter. So lest I be accused one day of shirking response to this charge, let us consider the background of the letter signed by Einstein et al. The ideology of Begin, his associates in the 1930s then thereafter, and the bulk of the revisionist movement within Zionism is a murky business. Until 1977, Begin was generally regarded as being on the lunatic fringe of Zionism, and after that date, he was rapidly liberated via Camp David and the Nobel Prize from the distasteful political and philosophical vestments of an earlier time. Einstein's attacks on Begin's fascism did not start in 1948, nor was it a matter of a woolly-minded physicist being recruited to revile Begin without any awareness of internal Zionist affairs. Einstein, himself a moderate Zionist, had been attacking revisionism, i.e. the movement which Begin now leads and which has always been the most militarist and rightist element in Zionism, militaristic and rightist element in Zionism, at least as far back as 1935. Why? A moderate Zionist like Einstein could, in 1935, point to the following characteristics of the revisionists. Now, I'm going to sum up the basics of this before proceeding with Coburn's text here, so you get some idea of just what Coburn is talking about before we get into it, because there's a lot of information presented here, and lest some of it go by you, I'd like to give you basically two chances to pick this up. Now, basically, the Beitarim, spelled B-E-T-A-R-I-M, or the revisionist Zionists, were an explicit fascist wing in the Zionist movement. That is to say, the international movement to get all of the Jews, or most Jews, to return to their biblical homeland of Palestine. Okay? Now, basically, the Beitarim, or revisionist Zionists, represented a fascist element within the Zionist movement. And among the things they did, they basically wore brown shirt uniforms. They associated and, in fact, took military training from Mussolini's naval cadets. Basically, they had a training school set up in Italy under the auspices of Il Duce. And basically, they received military training at this school. They were reviewed by Mussolini himself. And they gave the fascist salute, they sang the Italian fascist anthem, and their leader, a fellow by the name of Jabotinsky at that time, made it very clear that they were doing this because they felt had a strong affinity with the organization. They did not associate with Mussolini's fascists out of any felt sense of, basically because they felt obliged to in any way. They associated with Mussolini because they enjoyed his political views, and they felt to themselves to be affiliated with those kinds of views. And it's interesting that the Beitarim basically saw Zionism as the embodiment of the inherent superiority, what they felt to be the inherent superiority of light-skinned peoples over dark-skinned peoples. In other words, they saw the rise to power, one might say, of the Jews in the Middle East as basically a manifestation of some form of racial superiority. They were particularly supportive of Mussolini's invasion of Ethiopia, which they saw as a similar sort of phenomenon. In other words, they saw the Italians conquering the Ethiopians as a manifestation of the racial doctrine which they believed in, which was, as I said, explicitly racist and explicitly fascist. And it's worth noting, too, that the Beitarim did not work against the anti-Semitic regime of Poland. Rather, they encouraged Jews to travel to the Middle East. So keep in mind all of the things I just mentioned. I'm going to read the actual text in which Coburn presents this information. Now, bear in mind that Coburn's information, in turn, comes from an article, a letter, I should say, written to the New York Times by Albert Einstein, among others, in 1948. Continuing here with Coburn's accounting of the fascist wing within the Zionist movement, that is to say, the Beitarim. Coburn writes, "A moderate Zionist like Einstein could in 1935 point to the following characteristics of the revisionists. They had brown shirt uniforms. They had a naval training school in Civita Vecchia from 1934 to 1937 set up by Mussolini. In 1936, revisionist cadets, known as Beitarim, were reviewed by Il Duce himself. The March 1936 issue of L'Idea Sionistica describes the ceremonies inaugurating the new headquarters. The Beitarim commander ordered the triple chant, Vive l'Italia, vive il re, and vive il Duce. In other words, long live Italy, long live the king, long live il Duce, Mussolini. After which the Beitarim lustily sang the Italian fascist anthem. The revisionist leader, Vladimir Jabotinsky, deliberately stressed that it had not been necessary to have the school in Mussolini's Italy, where they were trained by the black shirts. It had been a matter of choice. Einstein, or any well-informed political person, could have quoted the financial director of the revisionist movement, Wolfgang von Wiesel, last name V-O-N-W-E-I-S-L, a good friend of Begin, as saying, as reported by a London Zionist paper World Jewry for June 12, 1936, that, quote, although opinions among the revisionists varied, in general they sympathized with fascism. He personally was a supporter of fascism, and he rejoiced at the victory of fascist Italy in Abyssinia as a triumph of the white races against the black. Where was Begin in all of this? Begin was the fire-eater of the revisionists, one of the most militarist-minded. Jabotinsky found his ranting to be, quote, the useless screeching of a door, unquote. In 1939, Begin became head of the Polish Beitar. The revisionist Irgun was being trained in Poland at Zakopane by the anti-Semitic Polish army in explosives, underground methods, and so forth. In return for this instruction, revisionists told the Jews of Poland not to struggle against the anti-Semitic regime, but to pack up and leave for Palestine. Of course, the overwhelming majority rejected. Begin escaped from Warsaw in September of 1939 in the company of his close friend Nathan Yellin Moore, last name Yellin hyphen M-O-R, editor of one of the revisionists' Warsaw newspapers. Fleeing to Lithuania, Begin was imprisoned by the Soviet secret police, sent to Siberia, and only reached Palestine in 1942. Yelin Moore arrived well before Begin and joined the so-called Stern Gang, unquote, a split-off from the Irgun. The Irgun, by the way, was a underground paramilitary organization conducting, paramilitary or terrorist activities, depending on your ideological orientation, on which side you were on, in Palestine before, during, and after World War II. Continuing here with Coburn's account, in 1941, Begin was one of the couriers for the Stern Gang's proposal for a wartime alliance with Hitler's Germany, portions of which follow. The following document was found after the war in the files of the German embassy in Ankara, and is quoted in full in German in David Yisraeli's Hebrew PhD thesis, The Palestine Problem in German Politics, 1889 to 1945. It is quoted and discussed against the context of the entire period in Leni Brenner's forthcoming Zionism in the Age of the Dictators. The German memorandum on the document is dated January 11, 1941. At this point, Avraham Stern called his movement the real Irgun Zwei Leumi, or National Military Organization, abbreviated NMO. I'm not going to go into the text of this memorandum right at this point. It basically is sort of typically turgid fascist prose, but it makes very clear that the NMO, the real Irgun Zwei Leumi, the National Military Organization, believed very strongly that basically they felt a strong affiliation with Nazi Germany, and that basically they saw Nazi Germany's policies towards the Jews as being consistent with their own. In other words, they saw German racialism as being beneficial to Zionism, and they sought a pattern of cooperation whereby the Third Reich would basically help them get German Jews out of Germany and into Palestine, and they in return would support the Third Reich's foreign policy goals, in particular the so-called Stern Gang, the NMO, was very much preoccupied with attempting to undermine the British, basically undermine Britain's Middle East Empire, which, of course, the Germans coveted. So it was in the interest not only of the Nazis to weaken Britain's Mid-East Empire, but also of the Zionists as well, and they cooperated, at least to a certain extent, toward that end. Now, Coburn here mentions that the actual military alliance between the Stern Gang and the Third Reich never actually took place, but we're going to take a look at an actual working link between the SS and the Haganah, one of the most important Zionist organizations, here in a minute. Now, after the section of Coburn's column in which he quotes the memorandum detailing a pattern of cooperation, or a proposed pattern of political and military cooperation between the Irgun, the NMO, and Nazi Germany, basically Coburn goes on to describe not only Begin's continued fascist activities on behalf of Zionism, but very significantly the presence in this Stern group, this NMO group, which advocated an alliance between Zionism and the Third Reich, of Yitzhak Shamir. Now, Yitzhak Shamir is currently the Israeli foreign minister, and he too has fascist origins, as Coburn writes in his column. By the time Begin arrived in Palestine, the notion of such an alliance with the Nazis was obviously horrifyingly ludicrous. Instead of joining his friend Yelin Moore at the Stern Gang, Begin went into the Irgun, the main revisionist military organization. But it is to be emphasized that Avraham Stern and Yelin Moore were not alone in proposing this alliance, that is to say, interrupting Coburn's text here, that is, the alliance between Zionism and Nazi Germany. The triumvirate which took over Stern's group after he was shot by the British in 1942 consisted of Yelin Moore, along with Yitzhak Shamir, the present foreign minister of Israel, and Israel Shaib Eldad, last name S-C-H-E-I-B-E-L-D-A-D, a prominent leader today of the extreme right Tehiva party, which recently became part of the Begin coalition with Yuval Neiman. See Israel's Real Strategy in the 80s. That, by the way, is from Annals of the Age of Reagan, the Village Voice issue of July 27th. Continuing here with Coburn's text, is it fascist baiting to cite this background? In my view, no. Let's remain agnostic about Sharon, but Israel today is not a fascist state. In distinction to the tyrannies which surrounded Israel, is a democracy for Jews and a dictatorship over Arabs, using repressive legal apparatus taken over from the British. On the other hand, the revisionist in the 1930s admired fascism in Italy. Even Jabotinsky, more cautious than his maximalist lieutenants, still apologized for it.